So welcome everyone to Investing for Generational Wealth. Before we begin, a quick disclaimer as always, we're not financial advisors. All investments are subject to risk, including possible loss of any money you invest. So perform your due diligence before making any financial decisions. And of course, consult your CPA and your attorney before making investments. So I'm your host today, John Lai, and welcome to today's episode. We will be talking with Brian Escuduro about syndications and why syndications might be right for you. So a little bit about Brian. He's the president and co-founder of First Gen Foundations. And he recognized the need for accessible education in real estate. And together with his partner, they amassed over 20 years of project management experience and then grew his portfolio to 20 million assets under management. Now they're on a mission to empower others with the knowledge and tools to build generational wealth through real estate. So I love those keywords, generational wealth, obviously real estate portfolio. Before we dive any further, Brian, do you want to tell us a little bit about what you're up to these days and how you got to where you are?
Yeah, so thanks for having me, first of all. You know, I appreciate it. And, you know, I took a long route, so I still have my W-2. And that along with some health issues with my wife had a big start and stop effect on my college years. Mm-hmm. But when I finished college, you know, I was in a decent position in the company. I'm a vice president at the company that I work at now. And, you know, when I got out, it was like, all right, I have some time left, right? Because I'm not in school anymore. What's the next thing? Is it going to be a master's degree, which would be about $50,000 in 3 years? Or real estate was always in the background, $50,000 in 6 months. I could find out if, you know, if I'm a loser or if I can do, you know, just do some good there. The reality was, you know, in my 30s, I started looking at my retirement. And I saw a gap, right? And because life was just moving the way it was, there was not much I could do, right? I was still in the 401k and, you know, opened up an IRA. And that was just kind of what I could get my arms around. But then as school finished, I had had an opportunity to really take a look at it. And that's where real estate came into play. You know, we dove in, probably went through 50 books in a few months, tons of podcasts, you know, tons of interviews, and just dove into bigger pockets and just really started educating myself. And as I was doing that, I was like, wow, this thing really works, right? You know, everybody always tells you real estate is great and, you know, there's a benefit to it. So as I scanned around myself, I live in South Florida. There are people that have tons of equity in their homes and, you know, reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad and understanding you know, how much of our net worth is locked up in our homes. You know, we saw an opportunity for people like us that had some success in their careers, right? So people that still have W-2s, and you know, the reality is not everybody wants to leave their 9-to-5 and go jet setting, right? Their life will never be that. And that was specifically the case with myself and who would be my eventual partner, who happens to be my brother. You know, he got in because he just wanted to not have to cut his grass, right? He wanted a few hundred bucks extra so that he could play with his kids, you know, on the weekend. And so for myself, you know, my wife has some health issues and the idea was, you know, if something were to happen to me, I want to make sure that there's enough passive income coming in. And, you know, we started building from there. So pretty quickly bought the first duplex. We invest outside of Miami. We don't invest here. It doesn't fit our buy box right now. So we currently have a few duplexes in Tennessee. We have 4 properties in Columbus, Ohio. And then we have a few syndications in Tampa, Florida, and Fort Worth, Texas. And so I guess our the thing that we move in is the fear of the unknown, right? And I've had to do that. So my job in media, there's a lot of moving pieces. You know, I manage a team of about 200 people. We work on projects and that team will grow to 400 or 500. The teams in those projects will go in, you know, above 1,000 people. And so there's just a lot of imperfect information and to be able to take those steps forward in that is really important. My partner's an engineer by trade. And so he's, you know, I can do the perfunctory, you know, checking of a property. And then he's a nerd. So like he just geeks out and he loves it, right? I love spreadsheets, but he loves them even more. And so, you know, we created a good system where we really help each other out in operations. And so partnering was a big thing that was important to me. You know, again, leading large teams, I understand the need for delegation. So I didn't really want to take all the pie for myself. And so that just doing that and being someone who is genuinely interested in serving the community, you know, it's put us in a good spot. You know, a couple of weeks ago, I was at a conference. I was able to speak to 1,000 business entrepreneurs in real estate. And we've only been open for 18 months. And our goal this year was to be in the black. And we hit that goal this week. And so, you know, because of the corporate experience, because of the leadership and management experience, we are able to add value to the teams we're a part of. And we've seen good results because of that.
Got it. Okay. Thank you for that. That's a great background. Now, people who are starting, and you know, this is a webinar about syndications, but people who are starting, much like you, who probably started with the duplexes, how did you go from duplexes to syndications? And you know, what was the impetus and your experiences there?
Yeah, so it will be a feather in my cap that we started in 2022. So we bought the first duplex in May. Second one was at the end of May. Then we went into a 6-unit in Columbus because the idea was we wanted, the first couple were in a non-appreciating market, right? Just in the middle of Tennessee. They're great little properties. They cash flow well. We're good. Then it was like, you know, every time I did another deal, I wanted to do something different. So on the 6-unit, we brought in a couple of JV partners. We did the 6-unit in Columbus, Ohio, which is a great appreciating market. Then the single family right next door. So now we own half of a city block. We're working on getting the rest of that so we can do a large multifamily there. Another duplex in Columbus, and then a triplex in Newark, which is it's about 10 minutes away from where the Intel factory is being built out in Columbus. So what happens? Interest rates start just moving at a breakneck speed. While we were looking at really game planning the Columbus acquisitions, deals stopped penciling out. It stopped making sense to bring an investor to join us on a duplex as a JV because we're going to eat away all of their returns. And again, there are people that do it and, you know, they do it well. Our goal is not to hurt someone that invests with us. But, you know, our goal is to actually take bullets for our investors. But I had joined a capital raising mastermind, and I went to a conference and they started talking about syndications. And, you know, there's a couple of things you can do with that information. One is like, oh, that's cool. And then, you know, just keep moving. But, you know, again, I tend to be someone that that enjoys educating myself and seeing what that does for others. And so out of that conference, what we saw was I was now starting to shop sponsors because we had about $800,000 in soft commits up to that point. And then my partner was still shopping smaller deals. And so, you know, I was really understanding what it took to be a sponsor, right? That was the intention and that was the goal. And so, you know, someone took a chance on us, right? And I know that all it took was someone who needed money, because at the end of the day, they don't know who I am. They don't care. They wanted the money that we brought to the table. And I knew that once we could land in the room with them, we could show off. And so a caution, right, it would be, you know, be careful who you're getting into a partnership with. Our first syndication, it was a great learning experience. You know, it was the team was a little bit disjointed, but that helped us shine, right? One of the things that I do is a lot of conflict resolution, you know, dealing with large teams, you're going to run into it. And so there was an unruly partner that, you know, basically it was like, hey, you go handle that, right? And so that then we began doing asset management, right? I'm an operational guy. My partner's an engineer. So it kind of made sense. And so we showed off, right? And I say that very humbly, genuinely. I'm very, very pleased to be brought into the loop. The person that brought us on, he started going through some really heavy family tragedy. And so he was out of the picture for about a year. And, you know, he was overseas, you know, he was in a country that didn't have internet, and it was just, it could have become very, very difficult. Long days, but the reality was we learned so much, we were really, really happy to do it. And then, you know, through that, we were able to help stabilize the property. More importantly, people saw that we are worth our metal, right? And so now we start getting calls like, hey, you know, there's some pretty big names in that partnership group, you know, published authors on Bigger Pockets and, you know, people that are big in the Rod Cleef camp. And so they started calling us and saying, hey, you're doing a great job. We have this deal. Do you guys want to join us? Do you want to join us? And, you know, deal flow stopped being an issue at that point, right? We can basically join any syndication we want. Again, you have to bring the money. And so if anyone wants to get started, if you can pool $500,000, most operators will let you have a seat at the table. And then you get in the room, you prove your mettle, and then it just starts flowing from there.
Now, did you want to join as part of the sponsor group, the GP, or some people join as an LP initially,
yeah,
learn from that experience, and then jump to the GP position?
Yeah. So my goal as jumping in as a GP was, we want to be KPs on these deals. Mm-hmm. And so I want to be around the conversation, right? I like having a say in, if there is an ability to create savings on one project or another, we want to have a seat at the table. So for example, on one of our properties in Texas, 123 units, early in the year before we took over, delinquencies were $40,000, right? And so an operator can go in and literally just start kicking people out. But we're not here to hurt tenants. We're not here to do that. That's not our goal, right? Our goal is to help educate, grow, and give. And so we got a new property management team in there, and they have a phone app. And the previous owner was knocking on doors, 123 doors a month. You're going to have problems, right? Let's use some technology. So literally sat with each of the residents, and our delinquencies went down to $4 within a month. Wow. So we like to look for creative solutions that benefit the tenants, and we like to take care of the property managers. They take care of the property takes care of the investors, and the investors take care of us. And so it's just a very, very linear formula for us. So we wanted to be a part of all those conversations, because as we start to divest some of our smaller properties, we will now be able to take on more as GPs, as KPs. So in the next year or two, we'll be doing that.
Yeah, that's great. How have you seen the market change? Like, obviously, interest rates went up. You got into a time where, some would say that the market for syndications is peaked, or maybe even past the peak, right? How has that impacted what you've seen in market? I mean, and to a lot of people, it's harder and harder to do deals, right? Because if you rely on bank financing, it's tough to come by these days.
Yeah. So, once you get into those circles, the deals are there, right? And you're dealing with smart people. Yeah. Nobody wants to get into these crazy deals anymore, right? So in 2019, 2020, money was like free almost. People were just getting into, more risky assets, and floating rate was a thing, and we did not do that. We look like geniuses now, right? Because you got a 5.65 fixed rate. What are you, dumb?
Right.
No, we're not. Again, our goal is consistency, right? I want to know what I'm getting more than hitting the grand slam. I'm a base hit guy. Let me get base hits, doubles. And so so you're seeing people that have a strong track record, and people, these are smart people, and they needed to do that floating rate proposition to make the deals good for their investors. But what happens? They are now finding out that if they didn't buy the rate cap, right? If the expenses have gone through the roof, even for us on one of those deals, expenses they're beating us up, but we are distributing, we're still doing well enough to distribute. And that's, again, just to me, that is a notch in our jacket that says, hey, we're still distributing on another couple of projects. We're at pref, so we are being creative with the management. As far as the deals penciling out, it's harder, right? But the reality is, if something works at 7 or 8%, in a couple of years when you can refi at 5 or 6, you're going to be in a better spot. So if you're telling your investors, a couple of years ago, hey, you're going to, pull off a 19-20% internal rate, you go back to them and say, hey, the reality is, these next deals are going to be within the 13-17%. That's right. Still better than the stock market. That's still better than their bank account. It's still better than the mattress. And so as long as you're educating the investors, you'll still find people willing to go with you. And if you're getting started, it's people that, they need to know, like, and trust you. And then on the acquisition side, the people that are moving, they're still moving. And in those spaces, right, if you run into those masterminds, if you run into, if you're active on LinkedIn, there's a lot of really solid operators that are more conservative than the flashy ones. And those that have, stuck around for a while, and they've been through these cycles and these crashes, they're still finding deals. And as far as like distress in the market, you know, Neil Bawa, I don't know if you're familiar with Neil Bawa, but he presented at the conference last week. And, you know, he was kind of pushing back a little bit on the fact that there is truly distress in the market. You know, I think it's something like 3,000 multifamilies are in, you know, quote unquote distress, which is like a 2%, 2.5% of what large multifamilies are in the market. So it's not to say that there is no distress, but it's like the sky's not falling right now. And so if you can find those deals within the next 18 months, you're going to be in a good spot, because a lot of these people, I was on a call earlier today where their goal is, you know, they don't even want to deal with capital calls. They'll just take the hit, they'll take the loss. And so they're disposing, you know, at discounts. And so if you can be prepared to jump in on some of those, you can find yourself in a really good spot in the next few years.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's value in not there's value, there's opportunity in the market, right? As you see a lot of these, and a lot meaning the 2%, 3%, but there are still opportunities to be had if you can find those, and if you're ready to, you know, if you're finance and are ready to jump on those opportunities.
Yeah, and a lot of that comes from the connections, right? So, you know, I have, again, you're just in these circles, right? It's not something that, you know, I do, but, you know, I'm at a meeting and somebody's like, hey, you know, just so you know, we'd really love to have you on our team. You know, me and my partner, you know, we can sign off for $65 million. So if I need someone to sign on documents for me, because I've been doing this now with a little bit of regularity, you know, we're doing well. You know, if you have a lot of you know, AWS folks on here, there's a lot of smart people, right? So you can add value to these teams. You know, someone's gonna sit there and say, hey, I like the way you do things. You know, I'm willing to, you know, partner with you on this. And I don't need to have $65 million, but someone else does. And now I know the guy that has $65 million. And so he's not gonna do the work that I'm doing because I don't have the 65 million. But you know, the option is there. And so he's taking down, you know, 200, 300 unit properties, and you know, he's the one calling us. And so, you know, you get in the room. You know, I think that's a big thing that people are afraid of, is getting in the room. But you know, this group of people that are listening now or will be listening on the recordings, right? A lot of them are, I'm sure, are high potentials. You know, they've been doing what they do for a while, and the reality is, you do add value to a team, and it's just getting in the room and showing them what you're made of. And if it's, you know, doing a design, I mean, sometimes it's going on Canva and doing a newsletter, and you just took that off of somebody's plate, and it was the easiest thing you could do, and they don't understand how to do it, or you know, to model something out for them. And so you'll find the teams that need, you know, certain skill sets, and if you can plug in on the GP side, great. And then as an LP, you're gonna want to look for those people, right? So there's a great book. It's called The Hands-Off Investor by Brian Burke, and that is basically a blueprint for LP investors. So if you're gonna be an LP investor, it really just goes through a lot of what you should be looking for. And I use that as a blueprint as an operator. Like, I'm like, oh, this is what the LP is looking for. This is who I need to be. You know, my communication cadence, you know, how they're going to evaluate a sponsor, you know, how I need to be evaluating real estate. Because the idea is, you know, he's giving me the equal side of the formula, and I just need to go back and reverse engineer that.
Right. Do you find that your buy box has changed? I mean, are you first of all, are you still sticking with syndications? It sounds like you are. Yeah, and the buy box, has that changed recently?
So for us, you know, it changed maybe in a weird way, but we're actually doing something outside of real estate for the next few months, right? I have a raise for something else. We'll be looking in the back half of the year. Our buy box actually kind of grew because our first syndication was 40 units, second one was 123. And so, I mean, when we got started, our goal was to get 8 units in 4 years. So again, you just take that next step. And what's the next logical step, right? We did the couple of duplexes, and then we're like, okay, let's go into an appreciating market. And then it was like, okay, let's just, you know, let's keep moving and moving. And so, no, it hasn't, right? The fundamentals are what they are. You know, we still want to get a couple hundred dollars a door. We don't want to necessarily look for the unicorn. And those are great when you can find them. And I know that the longer I do this, that unicorn will fall on my lap. You know, it's just being in the right place at the right time. And so, no, it hasn't. It hasn't. You know, the thing that we continue to look for is reputable partners, people that know what they're doing. And we have, you know, a really, really strong team in some of these projects. And it's great because you know, you learn to trust them. You know what their underwriting criteria is, you know, their communication style, you know, and sometimes these meetings can get a little testy, right? Because you have, you know, more than one person making a decision. But, you know, when you find a group of people that really care about the deal and the investors, you're willing to go through it. And so, you know, sometimes you got to get through the mud, but the idea that our criteria is still the same, right? We still have that 4-7% pref that we're trying to hit. We're still looking, you know, anywhere from 10-15%. And we like the B minus C plus class properties. We like the upward and downward pressure, right? So as the economy gets a little bit harder, A class might move down to B. D class will move to C if it gets better, but C doesn't typically move down to D. You know, they'll get another job as a mechanic or a waiter before they move their family into those rough areas. And so, you know, our occupancies, we're good. I mean, you know, we're 98% in one of the units, 123 units, and we're stabilized at 95% in the other ones. You know, it's a heavy lift to get there sometimes. But if you buy the right property in the right area, you'll be all right.
You mentioned now that you're in a good place, the sponsors coming to you, right? GPs are coming to you. How do others that may not be in your place evaluate, vet, and potentially underwrite sponsors, right? Whether they're an LP or GP, stepping into the GP or LP position.
Yeah, actually, you know, we have a document that's like 100 questions to ask a syndicator, and I'm happy to share it with you if you like. I can send that to you, and you can, you know, whoever wants it. But yeah, so it's having conversations with people, right? One of the things that we've lost a little bit is you know, dating people. And so when you're dating these sponsors, you know, quote unquote dating them, you know, there's a lot of flash, right? So you know, understanding what assets under management means doesn't mean, you know, we have $20 million assets under management. It does not mean that I own $20 million of an asset. It just means that's what I'm managing, right? Now, that is broken down in different portions and different tranches, you know, based on my JV split on this project or that project. You know, there are places, and you know, it's sad to say, but the marketing is very suspect, right? I see a lot of people with, you know, $100-300 million assets under management, and I know that they're rookies. And the reasoning is whatever sponsorship group they're a part of allows them to be, you know, to quote, be a part of everything that they have going on. So like the head of that group might have $300 million of assets under management. And just because I paid him $10,000 or $20,000 to be part of his mastermind, he's now letting me put on my website that we have that. And you know, you just want to be careful, right? So you know, have a conversation, you know, jump on the phone with someone. And, you know, on our end, you know, our first conversations are not like invest with us. It's like, hey, who are you? You know, what are your goals? What are the things you're looking for? Because the reality is, you know, we tell people, hey, you know, we're probably not right for you. And that's okay. You know, we can give you, you know, you might want to talk to such and such person. Like, hey, you want to do mobile home parks? Like, I'm not the guy. You want to do ATM funds? I'm not the guy. You want to do some syndications? You want to do them today? I'm not the guy, you know, but we know enough people and, you know, we've worked with enough sponsors to be able to, you know, to hand people off to people that, you know, we've either worked with or know. But again, the due diligence, you know, passive investment is not completely passive, right? You're still on the hook for who you're investing with. And I think that can be a misnomer for people. But, you know, you're writing big checks. Like you would do well to spend a few hours vetting the people and having conversations. We had an investor on one of our deals walk because one of the GPs hadn't finished their website, right? So they didn't have a good online presence. And this sponsor had 800 units. They didn't finish a website. And so I come back, I'm like, guys, I just lost a $100,000 investor because you didn't have your website done. Yeah. And that's okay. Like, you know, I talked to him, he's like, hey, I said, no, you need to feel comfortable here. You know, he came back on something else. He's super happy. But the reality is, like, those are the things. If you don't feel comfortable, good. Like, that's there for a reason. Don't just kind of blow past that. You know, right. Say, hey, you know what? John's got a nice shirt on. I'm going to give him, you know, $50,000. No, like, hey, John, why do you have that shirt? You know, what does it mean? You know, this and that.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. So you talked about underwriting, but can you describe your team makeup a little bit? Like, who's focused on, you know, acquisitions versus operations? Sounds like you're mostly focused on operations, but rest of your team?
Yeah, so I do capital raising. You know, my job is to grow the company, and you know, I am, I'll call it layer one of strategic partnerships. My partner Eduardo, he does more of the underwriting. He's like, we call it tier one, legal and finance. You know, we do have a team that we outsource, right? You're familiar with Who Not How. We are not the experts. We're not CPAs. So we have a CPA that helps us with that. We have a bookkeeper. We have lawyers on retainer that look at our legal documents. And even when we're partnering with someone, you know, we're finishing up a partnership with a group. We hired the lawyer, and you know, he's doing it, but we will still send those documents to the lawyers that we have on retainer. And the idea there is, you know, we're gonna let the experts be the experts at what they are. And then we also have back office support. We have an analyst. She does everything. I mean, she's from, you know, putting reports together to social media to, you know, hosting a webinar that we did yesterday. You know, she's incredible. And so, you know, I'm a big believer in delegation and partnerships. It's more fun to do it with more people. But the reality is we would not have been able to grow without that. And the structures are a little bit, they can be clunky if you let them. But, you know, we subscribe to the traction model to EOS by Gino Wickman. And so that has really helped us just really line up what we want to do. Everybody knows the goals. Everybody knows the vision, you know, and then we work on rocks. So it's 90 days, guys. What are the 90-day goals? And and again, we reset and move. And we're an iterative growth company. So, you know, our first webinar yesterday, it was solid. It was our first one. And my wife asked me, she's like, are you nervous? Are you excited? And I said, I am super excited about the end of it. Well, we're going to be able to look at all the things we did wrong.
Right.
And, you know, and so, you know, taking that mindset, I have to be careful with that because, you know, you do that enough and you stop celebrating the wins. Yeah. So we had a big win yesterday. And so I had to, like, you know, because I was like, oh, we did this. We did, you know, we need to fix this or that. But, you know, it was a big move for us. And so we were pleased with it. And yeah, you want to find people that you can work with in that sense, right? There are people that are just go, go, go. They don't stop and think. And for us, you know, I think one of our competitive advantages is that we both have our W-2. Like, we don't eat off of this, you know?
Yeah.
This is a company that's growing. You know, I do well enough. You know, I live well beneath my means. My partner does well enough. He lives well beneath his means. We don't have to get into any crazy deals. If the thing doesn't pencil out, we're not trying to force it. And we don't need to close 10 deals a year for everyone to make, you know, 8 figures. Not knocking that, we'll get there. But the reality is, as we grow, we don't need to do it.
Yeah, that's interesting because a lot of people in our position, W-2s, they aspire to, you know, be their real estate investor status, professional status, right? And they want to get there at some point. Whereas I think there is value in maintaining your W-2 until you get to a point where, you know, you feel comfortable and that passive income, you've gotten to a point where you think that passive income sustained itself.
Yep.
So it's that is an
yeah. It's unfortunate. I've seen a lot of people jump out,
yeah,
and go go go. It's just, I mean, you know. And again, I have a good job. You know, make a good salary. You know, I know that I've worked with AWS folks. Good jobs, good salaries. It is not easy to duplicate that. You know, and so, you can fall in love with that idea, and it can be dangerous. I've seen a lot of people leave and then have to come back. Tail between their legs. And it's not that they didn't do well. It's just that they were doing so well before and they didn't realize, man, you know, replacing this salary is not, and to keep it going, it's not easy. Right. And so, you know, there'll be a day where it doesn't make sense. And that's, you know, in the future for me one day, I'm not rushing for it. I really, you know, I'm thankful. I enjoy my job. You know, we've been able to build a great team. I don't go a day without laughing till my stomach hurts, you know, and it's just a function of the industry I'm in. But, you know, it took me about 7 years to get that team going. You know, I remember, you know, it was a huge project. And one day I walked 15 miles indoors, 15 miles for this project. And then the next few years we did it again after the team had been set up. And I looked down and I was like, oh, I had walked a mile. And I really pulled the team aside and I was like, hey, I want to tell you guys this story. 4 years ago on this day, I had to walk 15 miles because there was no one here with me. And it was really difficult to make sure everything was running and it was really hard and this and that. But because we've been able to build this team, put these systems into place, put these processes, you know, you literally made me enjoy the day. And so we try to bring that into what we do in real estate.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. So you learn a lot in the last, call it like 2-3 years, and you know, throughout your life. But in real estate, I'd love to hear maybe your top, maybe three best practices, and then maybe my next question would be like, what are your, you know, top learnings and maybe like failures where you learned from, you know, your experiences.
So I'll start with the failures, if that's okay.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, my big fail, like it was like, I can't believe it, was bookkeeping. So stupid. It's so stupid, right? So I was like, you know, I'll just take a note. But when you're building a business, you're moving a lot of money, like just from one account to another. And so because we scaled quickly, you know, every property has its own LLC. And then there was a second LLC. And then wait, the money was coming from my bank account, so I had to move it there. And then there was a third LLC and a fourth and a fifth and a sixth. And so as we're growing, because everything has to be siphoned off, right? We don't commingle the assets or anything like that. And then, I don't know, 8 months, 9 months in, you know, it's tax time. I'm like, I need a bookkeeper. I need a bookkeeper. Right, right. And so then it was a buddy, because so I graduated with a business degree. But this was a guy, again, in the start and stop. I had been in accounting school with him. Mm. And he kept going, right? He opened up his company. Someone that I would study with, you know, and I know he's a good guy. So I'm like, hey, I need your help with bookkeeping. And so he starts calling me and he's like, what the heck, man? And so I'm like, you know, I'm apologizing. I'm like, I'm really sorry. But, and it took weeks for me to get it done, because there's just, you know, there's transactions I need to get, you know, reconciled and all that stuff. So bookkeeping was huge. That was a huge learning curve. And then the second one was kind of holding things a little too close to the chest.
Yep.
Right. It wasn't purposing to give the vision of what we were doing. And I guess second and third is being okay with dreaming, right? Dreaming big. And mm-hmm. so, you know, as a first gen investor, you know, my parents came from Colombia 50 some odd years ago. You know, you're not really taught to do that. You know, it's go, 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 it's work. The only way you make more money is work more hours, right? And that's it. And so doing it all again, I wish I would have given more time to that in my younger years, right? If I only knew then what I know now. But also not letting that hold me back and saying, hey, you know what? Today is the day. Let's just freaking let's get to it. Let's get started. And so, so bookkeeping, holding things too close to the chest, and being scared to talk about it, say, hey, I'm doing this thing. Right. And I lost a little bit of time doing that, not too much. And then being afraid to dream, right. We're working on some things that I think could shift the landscape for the first gen investor in the country. And I don't think I'm overselling that. And so, if we get that going, you know, we will hit our first, you know, our tagline is educate, grow, give. If we hit that, we're going to be able to educate the country. And so that, and then as far as best practices, as I've spoken to more people, a lot of people are amazed that I had a business plan before I bought my first property. And so I thought that was really solid. That was a good move for us. And the story goes, I was ready to put the offer on the first property. And, you know, I'm all like, you know, I'm in a good mood because I know they're going to accept it. And my wife says, hey, who are we going to help? I'm like, us. And she's our business plan, right? Because, you know, I went over with her, was every property we buy, we're going to help somebody. Who are we going to help? Turned into a 3-hour conversation, right? About the realities of who we are and what we're going to be doing with this company. And I thought that was just an amazing moment for the birth of the company. So that to me was a really, really good best practice. Like, hey, let's just hunker down and know what we stand for. The second best practice for me is partnerships. So again, I can do everything I do, I can do on my own. My website, I can do it on my own. Or I can pay someone else to do it, because it's going to take me 6 months to do it wrong, right? Because I still have the rest of my life to do it. So so partnerships and employing others to do that. And then being loud about the thing. I'm not someone that enjoys being in front of camera, you know, but if you find the essence of what you're trying to do, and I shared about it on the stage at Race Fest, my mother-in-law, pretty early on, she's like, when is enough? Like, she was just like, a genuine question. Like, when is enough? And I said, I stopped for a second. And I said, you know, if we're helping people, it's never going to be enough. And so having those drivers like they helped me get in front of a camera. And I know it's important to be in front of a camera to talk about this. Again, my passion is not necessarily real estate. It's helping people. And so we're able to help our tenants. Like I said, we're able to help the property managers, we help our investors, and they help us. And we're on the bottom of that. And you know, our first, you know, our core values, the first one is we're others focused. And I think that comes from us growing up, you know, not with a ton of money, but we were still always very charitable. My parents, I remember they would build a house in Colombia for like, you know, a shack for $1,000 every year. And, you know, we didn't go on fancy trips and this and that, but we were always, you know, we were taught to give. And I remember visiting migrant camps and just helping people. And that stuck with us. And again, as I joined forces with my brother, like that was like, hey, this is what we're about.
I do have a question about how do you give back to your community? But I think you answered that. You know, it's basically education, education first, and then to the extent that you can, like donating your time, giving back to your community.
And also money, you know, so we, you know, it's part of who we are, you know, we're men of faith. And so, you know, we tithe off of what the company makes, right? So we donate into the local communities. So the Tennessee properties, there's a charity that we're donating there. In Columbus, you know, in Tennessee, it's for women in distress. In Columbus, it's more food security. And then, you know, as these other properties start spinning off a profit, we donate off of that.
That's great. Yeah. If you were to go back 10, 20 years to a younger version of you, like what advice would you give to yourself with respect to real estate, but also just generally?
So with respect to real estate, it would just be to get started, right? The biggest shift that happened for me in the last few years was understanding the difference between I cannot to how can I. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there to this day, there's an excuse on why I cannot. And then I'll finish the sentence with whatever you want. But the reality is, you know, shifting that mindset, and that comes from Robert Kiyosaki, to how can I? And so, again, there's always going to be an excuse. You know, 10, 15 years ago, I was not in the place to invest in real estate unless I would have said, hey, how can you invest in real estate? And there's going to be a way. And it might have taken longer and I didn't have the money to jump in right away. But taking a look at my retirement, like that really opened my eyes. It was like, it doesn't matter what's going on. You die before you get there, you're gonna hit retirement age. And so it's something that you need to look at. And a lot of people are afraid to look at it. But when you take a look at it, you'll learn one of three things. One is you're further behind than you want to be. The second is you're further along than you want to be. The third is you're right around where you want to be. And what that does is it informs the path going forward. And so if I would have done that 10 or 15 years ago, I'm confident that if I would have started investing in my 20s, I would have retired by the time I was 45, knowing what I know. And this is not having a PhD. It's literally, you know, I have a good marriage. I put time into my marriage. I have a job that takes a lot of my time. And I know that if I would have known what I know then, what I've learned in the last couple of years, I would have retired by the time I'm 45.
Yeah, that's great. How do you continue developing your skills? So it sounds like you learn quite a bit, either on the job or on projects, or you know, others could have gone to masterminds. How do you learn, and how do you continue that continuous learning, those life skills?
Yeah, so I put myself in positions to fail a lot, right? Mm-hmm. I don't fear that, and I know that part of that comes from the security I have in my support system. Like my wife, she's my biggest critic, but she's my biggest cheerleader. And so, you know, even after yesterday's webinar, you know, on the team, like everything's great. Hey guys, you did great, all this stuff. And I'm like, all right, now I'm going to go talk to my wife and really see how it went. And so I'm a really harsh critic on myself. And I was like, man, we tried to pump too much information. You know, we should have done a drip campaign before the webinar, you know, all these things that I know. And even she like pulled me back a little bit. She's like, hey, you just wanted to do one, like you got through the one, you should celebrate that. Right. And so, but putting yourself in positions to fail on purpose are huge. You know, if it's a book that you don't have the time to read, start reading it. If it's a webinar that you've never done before, put on the webinar. You know, for me, I read a ton, you know, and I actually had to stop reading so many business and real estate books for a bit, because your mind needs time to rest and reflect on what's going on. You need time between those lessons. And so I was compressing everything into the last couple of years. And, you know, you just, you kind of get that brain fog where, and it's subconscious, but you won't absorb as much. So I give myself more space, right? I joke around, you know, I'll do it on LinkedIn or on Instagram where I say, have you started a wall lately? And let's just go in and start a wall. Because your brain needs time to absorb what you've been learning, you know, to really find out the application of the things you've been learning. So I do that more than ever. My tablet is not in my room anymore, right? I leave it in the office, right? So I sleep better. I wake up earlier. And so those things of resting the mind are very important, especially if you're in a dynamic work environment or something that pulls a lot on your brain to get through. I don't do physical labor anymore. Like when I would do productions, I was like, I put in pushing the button and all that stuff. And now I don't, right? It's more of it's an executive role. I'm looking at spreadsheets and, you know, coaching and mentoring and all this stuff. But the reality is if you're, you know, I have decision fatigue at the end of the day, you know, my wife, she's like, she wants to talk. And she didn't realize until after, until COVID hit, where I was working from home more, that I talked for 12 hours a day. So I wasn't like in the mood at the end of the day to come in. And that's on me. Again, I had to start cutting things shorter because she did not sign up for that. And it's not on her for me to fix, you know, my work life. But the reality is it was slowing things down. So I constantly read. I read a lot, love books, love to learn, podcasts, you know, pick your favorite. Hunter Thompson's great. You know, Andy McQuaid that does the total cost of ownership method. He's amazing. You know, I'm a big Bigger Pockets guy. So on the real estate side, and then, you know, any number of, if you haven't read The Go-Giver, great, phenomenal book. You know, I'm what am I reading now? I'm reading Hands Off Investor again by Brian Burke. So I'm starting to read more books several times, then, you know, continue to open up to more information. It's just kind of understanding and niching down on the information that I need. So yeah, I could talk about learning for a long time. I enjoy it.
And yeah, that was also another question I had, which is like, how do you, it sounds like you consume a lot of education through books, podcasts. The other thing about education is networking, right? And that's part education, but part business development. Yeah. What do you do for networking? How do you build your circle of influence?
Yeah, so I think something that a lot of people don't realize with networking is what it does is it accelerates your education. So a true story, there's a gentleman by the name of Matthew Owens. He's pretty significant in California. I'm part of a mastermind called Raise Masters, right. And he's on there. So I was considering doing a debt fund a little while ago, about a year and a half ago. And, you know, being part of that network, one of the, you know, they have like an accountability coach. And so I mentioned it to him. He's like, hey, why don't you talk to Matthew? So Matthew's not going to pick up my call, but he is because I'm in this mastermind. Right. And so I call him and, you know, I have a meeting with him about a debt fund, and he has, you know, a $35 million debt fund. And so we get on this call, and about, you know, in about 20 minutes, we realize he helps me realize that that's not the thing that I need to be doing. And that eventually rolls into another project. So not only did he saved me about 6 months of testing and, you know, back office stuff and spending money that I didn't need to spend. So that's a huge win for me, right? It compressed the timeline of learning.
Right.
And then now I move into a partnership with him on something else. So now I have like, you know, these top tier operators that I can work with. You know, I've been on the phone with Robert Beardsley, right? This guy has $600 million assets under management. He does huge things in Dallas. But because I paid some money to be in a group, those guys will pick up the phone. And so networking is really important in that sense. And that's when you want to pay to play. If you don't, there's great networking opportunities. You know, and I speak about it because it was a couple of weeks ago, but at RaceFest, you know, at least me, one of the best things I've learned is that the real estate community is very giving with their time. So one of the things I said from the stage is like, hey, I don't have anything to sell. I'm just here to help. Like if, you know, I was where you were a couple of years ago, if I can help you, come look for me. And so people started coming to look for me. And anyone that came to look for me, I gave them the amount of time that they needed, made a lot of good connections. And, you know, I give them my contact. I'm like, hey, look, you know, set up a call. And anyone that has set up a call, I give them the time that I can because somebody did that for me. And so, you know, anyone on this webinar or, you know, listening to the podcast, you know, reach out, you know, genuinely. You know, maybe one day I become too busy to do that, but my goal is to never be that busy, right?
Yeah.
You know, there are people that that need the help, and you know, educate is our first goal, grow is the second, and give is the third, and in that order.
Yeah, like I love that. Speaking of which, if you have any questions for Brian, please drop them in the chat, and we can address those questions. So a couple of things. One, it sounds like you're big into passive investing, but also into holding your investments. Do you ever see exit strategies? Like, what is your exit strategy 5-7 years?
Yeah, so like I mentioned, the Tennessee properties, those were our first properties, and they're great, and I love them. But, you know, again, if you want a good podcast to listen to, Andy McQuaid, TCO Method, he talks about the total cost of ownership. And so those things are piping off, you know, a few $100 a month. So the day that I go on a plane and rent a car and spend the night in a hotel to go look at two duplexes, I eat all my profits.
Right.
So I will be divesting of those. What did those two properties do? They are the learning properties, right? I remember like people talking about them, like who the heck buys a house to learn? Like that sounds like so crazy. But again, you take the next logical step, right? I had all this knowledge and, you know, I needed to transition it into wisdom. And so how do you do it? You buy a couple of properties. Okay, great. So we will divest of that. Why? Because we have to look at return on equity. And we do that on every project we have. So people like to hold forever. You know, I have an investor that he called me the other day, and he's like, man, I have these four properties. I'm like, great. He's like, they're all paid off. I'm like, bad. And so I said, look, we need to do a return on equity calculation for you. And he's like, I know. And so everyone's different, right? So our syndications, one is for 3-4 years. The other one will be 5 to 6 years. The JVs, again, I'm divesting of a couple in the next year or two. We want to make sure that we make some money off of them. So we're letting the market come back a little bit, but they're cash flowing well for us. You know, there's other ones that, you know, the plan is to hold on to those for a really long time because of the land under it, right? We bought them and they're cash flowing. They're doing fine. But the reality is they're in great appreciating markets. And so as we spread out in that neighborhood, we now force the appreciation of the neighborhood. And so everything's different. Like I'm not afraid to hold something in perpetuity, and I'm not afraid we don't have any losses that we're trying to cut, but I'm not afraid to move on to changing the strategy of what we have going on.
Yeah. You talked about return on equity. Like what other KPIs do you have? Either potentially considering a property or potentially exiting a property, or maybe even in between as you're operating.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have relationships with the brokers, right? We want to make sure that right now with the cap rates fluctuating, they right. really drive the value of a property. And so even going in with LPs, we tell them, hey, the plan is that this would be a 3-year hold.
Yep.
The reality is that can, you know, we're not gonna hold it for 6 years, but it might go into 4 and a little bit. Our 3-year hold, we might even dispose of early because we've been able to add so much value to it. Like we haven't had to pump a bunch of money. It's a great, great value for us. So we look at that, you know, we keep an eye on occupancies just because the NOI is driven by that expenses. So our expense ratios, you know, we look at EBITDA on each, you know, they're all their own companies, right? We look at EBITDA and, you know, that's part of the finance team. And so again, one of the things that I'm able to understand is running businesses. And so a lot of people in this space, we'll call it, they're hustlers, right? I'm familiar with, you know, I'm buddies with and then partners with people that have flipped thousands of homes. They might not really understand what EBITDA is, right? They're freaking rock stars, but they don't understand the nuances of that. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that we bring to the table. So we look at EBITDA. We're looking at vacancy loss. We're looking at economic loss. We really like to get into the weeds of just the smallest adjustments that we can do, you know, as we look for additional income, you know, is it, you know, you can change to low flow filters, you know, low flow toilets, concierge trash. How can we drive those numbers? You know, we want to bring the revenue up, keep the expenses down. We do annual audit of any contract services we have. And so if you're cutting the grass for us for a year, doesn't mean you're going to keep cutting grass for us, you know, if you can't stay competitive. And so, you know, we have probably about at least a couple dozen KPIs that we keep an eye on pretty regularly.
Okay. What do you, I'm interested in this because we do, we consider a lot of opportunities for syndication or anything else. What do you look for as like the shorthand for those key metrics? Like, do you look at cap rate, you know, cost to yield and so forth?
Yeah, so cap rate's a little tough because it varies so much. Right. And, you know, you have very little say in it. So, I mean, we like to focus on the things that we can drive. And that's why NOI for us is a big one. You know, I look at rent revenue next to other revenue. It's something that not many people do, and I'm not saying that I'm smart for doing it, but a lot of people don't realize that rent revenue is your base, and that's really what you should be underwriting to, because other income can fluctuate a lot. You know, if you're getting a lot of applications and, you know, you have other, you know, one-offs, right? You know, so we're adding, you know, bulk internet to some of these properties, and we're getting like, you know, you'll get a, you know, $8,000, $12,000, $15,000 chunk. That throws off a lot of those metrics. And so we like to underwrite, just we keep things above the line where we can. We move things below the line when we have to, because we want to be really conservative with our numbers. And, you know, that's something that I knew, and that you know, we walked away from a lot of deals because of that. And I'll say I'm glad we did, right? We're not in a ton of deals because the way we underwrite is, you know, probably a little too conservative, but, you know, we want to be getting what we know we're going to get.
Got it. Okay. So we're about time. And I thank you very much for your time, Brian. Brian, I see your information there. Is this the best way to contact you? How do they find out more information about FirstGen and what you do?
Yeah, so our website is firstgenfoundations.com. You know, you can download, you know, we have an article that we write. It's 7 reasons why multifamily investing makes sense. We have quite a few articles on there that we've written. I'm very active on LinkedIn, on Instagram at First Gen Foundations, and on TikTok. We do some stuff on TikTok, but yeah, best bet is going to be the website. My calendar is on there. You know, if you reach out, you're going to be talking to me. And the goal would be just to see how we can help out. Some people will invest with us. Some people won't. Some people just want general information. And I love those conversations. You know, my favorite ones are, you're not ready to invest yet, but, you know, we can help you get to a place where you can invest in a short amount of time. So also we do, one of the big things that we're doing, or we've done, we developed a HELOC model. My partner did, he's smarter than me. So what this does is it calculates for you, if you have a lot of equity in your home, what you should be looking at as far as returns. You can basically create a debt fund for yourself. So, you know, if you have, you know, we have an investor that had $500,000 in equity, they invested $300,000, and they have this $200,000 debt fund to play with. So they can fully fund the project without pulling out money from their pocket. And, you know, it really is helping people get into the game that previously didn't think they had an opportunity to do it. So that's something that we share with our prospective investors.
Yeah, I fully subscribe to the HELOC model. I'm doing that myself. Not so much with projects as much as, well, I am investing in the project. And it's been lucrative. So I'm glad I've done it. So
yeah, it's basically creating an infinite investing source for yourself.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, very good. Thank you, Brian, for the time and taking time out of your busy schedule to speak to our audience. Don't forget to like and subscribe to both this webinar and our podcast on whichever platform you're listening to make sure that we can continue bringing you the best educational content. Thanks, everyone. And until next time, keep learning to invest for generational wealth.
Thanks, Sean.
Brian, feel free to, we'll send you the information, the recording. If there's anything that we can do for you, let us know. We're capital raisers as well.
Okay.
We're also looking for opportunities. We are actively looking at opportunities interestingly enough, we're invested with Rob as well, Rob Beardsley in Houston, but we are looking at other opportunities in Texas. So
okay. So we're with a good team in Fort Worth. I mean, we got a great deal there, you know. I mean, you know, we haven't had to put much. I mean, you know, when we got it, it was there was, I think it was like 90% occupancy. It's a five-year average tenancy. We're up to 98% pre-lease for the next few months. Like it's solid. We push rents to market with very little, you know, CapEx. Yeah. It was just not managed properly. And so, you know, there's a couple of things that we're looking at there. I did mention, you know, I couldn't go into it on the webinar, but we're working with a debt invalidation fund, which is very interesting. So it's a 18-month hold, $25,000 minimum investment. And it's, you know, it's piping off 20% internal rate. Start getting your capital back in month six. By month 16, you have all invested capital back, and then 30% profit over that. Yeah. So, you know, so that is like, that's a diversification play for our investors. And, you know, so we're focused on that for the next few months, right? We're going to raise $1 million for that. And then we'll look for, you know, for the next real estate deal in the summer.
The assets that is invested in that particular investment, is that mostly like short term type of option?
So you're buying you are buying notes, right? You're not buying debt. Yeah. So this is I'll explain to you in 30 seconds. But so MasterCard, I'm a debtor to MasterCard. MasterCard sells my debt to Miami Collection Agency.
Right.
Miami Debt Collection Agency needs a certain amount of documents. Fair Credit Reporting Act made it illegal for this transfer to happen, for all these documents. So we work with a company that's been up since 2017. They've done this 70, 75,000 times. They go, they come to me and say, "Hey, Brian, do you want to work with us?" You know, they buy tranches of debt, right? We're going to go talk to the company. If you sign up with us, we'll put you into an accounts receivable for $8,000. The average is $20,000 debt, and it's a sliding scale. But so $8,000 average for a $20,000 debt. You go into a debt invalidation process, because they now go to Miami Collection Agency and say, "Show us the documents that prove you can legally collect these funds from Brian, that is your debt to collect." And 90% of the times they don't. Yeah. And so now they get a cease and desist letter. We go through a debt invalidation process. We're giving Brian a lot of education on financial well-being. He goes through this. It's $430 again, the average $430 for 3 years. His debt is wiped clean because there was an illegal transaction that happened behind the doors. And so there's that. On the investment side, again, it's you start collecting 5% return on month seven. So it's 5, 5, 5, 10, 10, and 10. So by year one, you have 45% of your invested capital back. Then the rest is by month 16, and then you get 15 and 15 off of month 17 and 18. Which is really good for, you know, when we're dealing with syndications that are so long, right? Where you got 5 years, you know, 4 years. We were looking at one for 7 years, and we're like, people are not going to want to join that. Yeah. So this is a good diversification play for that. And, you know, once we're done, we'll do it again, right? The company is doing well. And I'm actually going to call the owner now. He actually moved to California to just kind of make it more lean and mean. And, you know, it's a good resource. They also do a lot of stuff with military. And so we're going to do that out here with military and police, just helping them get more financial education. And so that's the charitable arm of it. Everything that we do, we want to have a charitable arm to it. And so, you know, our goal is by the end of 25 to have the First Gen Foundation's charitable arm up and running as a nonprofit. So, you know, I mean, there's good things coming down the pike. You know, that despair that's out there, I think it's scaring a lot of people, but the reality is if you just kind of get past that, just get past a little bit of what the media is feeding you, there's good stuff happening down here. There's some strong fundamentals out there still. So,
yeah. And are you operating using a fund of funds
we're doing a fund of fund on that one.
Got it.
But typically we do the co-GP model for syndications.
Yeah.
I'm not against the fund of funds, but the issue is this, the first gen investor likes the fact that I'm in the project. They like the fact that we're there. Yep. And so, you know, there are, we have accredited investors that don't care. They're like, "Dude, just give me my money. I don't care if you're there." But, you know, the audience that we're speaking to, the audience that's come, you know, they're a little bit more nervous. And so they like the fact that I could pull someone's ears. You know, when we got in on the Tampa deal, and maybe we should have talked about this a little bit, but when we got on the Tampa deal, the pro forma was at $14,500 per turn. They were spending $20,000. It was 2 months. They were taking 4 months. So again, I'm the rookie in there, like full stop, rescope, readdress, reassess. We got it down to 15 days and we're at $10,000 a turn. And so, you know, the fact that we can do that for our investors is really, you know, important.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Well, thanks for your time. Anything
John, I appreciate
you, by all means, let us know.